Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the gas program at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Vitaly Yermakov, who is senior research fellow at the gas program at the OIS. And we're here to discuss his paper, The Northern Sea Route, a state priority in Russia's strategy of delivering Arctic hydrocarbons to global markets, that was published in November 2021. Vitaly, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Hello, David, and it's good to be here back to the OIS podcasts.
Excellent. Well, look, why don't we start by defining what we mean by the Northern Sea Route, or NSR, and how does it compare with other global shipping routes?
Well, first of all, obviously, with the title of the paper, you've given up the key message. And I think it's exactly right to start with defining what do we mean by the Northern Sea Route, because sort of there's this broad definition, this connection between a sea passage from the Atlantic to the Pacific through the Northern Seas. And there's a narrow definition, it's like a technical definition, because the NSR for Russia has clearly stated boundaries. Its western boundary is along the meridian of Cape Jelania. It's the eastern coast of Novaya Zemlya and the straits of the Kara Sea. And then it stretches along Russia's Arctic coast to its eastern boundary at Cape Dezhnev. That's the easternmost point of the Russian mainland. And then to the demarcation line between the territorial waters of Russia and the U.S. and the Bering Strait. So basically, it crosses all Russian Arctic seas. And it's the key point. It connects by a relatively short route the Atlantic and the Pacific and Europe and Asia.
Okay, so probably a bit of an obvious question now, but you say in the report that the Northern Sea Route is Russia's state priority in the Arctic. You know, can you just kind of confirm to that? You know, why is that? I think you just explained that because it borders so many other countries, but perhaps you can build upon that.
Well, first of all, obvious economic rationale for making the NSR state priority is that this route, since the Soviet times, has served to supply Russian northern territories. Because, I mean, otherwise it would be extremely difficult to bring anything there. Now, in addition to that, because this sort of continues, in addition to that, now I think it is a way for Russia to unlock the tremendous hydrocarbon reserves in the Russian Arctic and deliver them to global markets economically. That's the economic rationale for making it a priority. But then I think there's a very strong geopolitical rationale that has emerged now, and it has to do with these growing global rivalries we are seeing. And in this sense, sort of a route controlled by Russia and that connects Europe with Asia, Europe with China, and sort of the deliveries through this route cannot be interrupted by the U.S. Navy, for example. I think it's an important bargaining point for Russia in its overall relationship with China, for example. And I think that's a new development we are seeing in the past decade.
Now, you're kind of in the paper. You're kind of saying the Northern Sea Route is the Russian marine route, but you know, do other nations actually recognize Russia's exclusive rights to set out the rules for navigating via the Northern Sea Route? What's the situation on that, Vitaly?
Well, the legal aspect, I think, is important. And Russia used the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea because there's an Article 234 of the Convention, which states that coastal states essentially have the right to adopt and enforce non-discriminatory laws and regulations for the prevention, reduction, control of marine pollution from vessels in ice-covered areas. Basically, I'm reading now from the text of this article. And the meaning is that if indeed there's a danger to the environment, if it is the danger to the Arctic, where any pollution would be extremely difficult to contain and repair the damage, then the states can indeed introduce some regulations on the rules of navigations. And that's the rationale, and that's sort of the legal ground Russia has been using to justify the requirements it has introduced for travel through the Northern Sea Route. And the requirements are essentially that any ship that wants to navigate through the NSR should notify Russian appropriate authorities. Russia would provide piloting services and charge for those services. And also Russia would provide icebreaking support services and also charge for those services. And this might be quite expensive. Other countries sort of look at the possibility of traveling through the Northern Sea Route, especially in the future if the weather gets warmer and the route becomes ice-free for longer periods, as basically as their right. And the U.S., for example, has insisted that the right of innocent passage should apply to the territorial waters within the NSR, and especially for warships. So basically, I think there's still some uncertainty of whether other nations do recognize sort of all the requirements that Russia has introduced. But the practice for now is that essentially there's no ship that can travel through the Northern Sea Route and not follow sort of the Russian rules. And it's really more a matter of technical safety, because as we will discuss later, I hope, basically it's still a tremendous navigational challenge due to the ice conditions. And Russia is really the only country that can provide icebreaking support in the area that can ensure the travel.
Let's talk about the kind of the whole role of the Russia nuclear icebreakers later on. And by the way, for those of you listening to this podcast, if as we talk about kind of the route, do go to Vitaly's paper that has a map, so it'll help you kind of follow what we're talking about. But let's kind of go back to the Northern Sea Route itself, because in your paper, you call the Northern Sea Route, you know, the Arctic shortcut, which implies shorter travel distances to target markets, which is an obvious advantage of the Northern Sea Route. But perhaps you can tell us, you know, what are the disadvantages that have limited the use of the route so far?
Well, yes, if one looks at the map, obviously the distance is shorter compared with sort of other route from Europe to Asia. It's via the Suez and around India. For example, the travel time through the Northern Sea Route from Europe to Asia to China for modern ships is about 3 weeks, provided basically they can travel at their design speeds. Recent shipments to China by large LNG carriers from Novatek's Yamal project, and this is sort of, it's not all the distance from Europe, because Yamal sits sort of two-thirds of the way sort of towards Asia. That travel time basically took 11-12 days to go from Yamal to reach northern China's ports. And in this sense, if the vessels can maintain their normal speed of 17, 18, 19 knots, then this passage really provides sort of the ships with very significant time and obviously cost savings. But the key disadvantage is that for many months during the year, the route cannot be navigated at normal speeds. Basically, if ships must travel through ice and sometimes through thick ice, then the travel speed is greatly reduced. They need icebreaking support, which costs money. And generally, not all ships can go through the NSR, especially sort of during colder months. It must be a special Arctic class, Arc 6, Arc 7 types of ships, which again are more expensive to build. So in this sense, the key disadvantage is still in northern latitudes, the travel is more uncertain. You cannot really bet that you can travel through the whole route in 2 weeks. It may be a delay, unexpected, and then basically there will be additional costs incurred. So that has been a key uncertainty around the route. And this is, by the way, why not much international transit has traveled through the route. So far, it has been mostly shipments from Russian hydrocarbon projects in the Arctic that really has taken the lion's share of the overall cargo, of the overall turnover.
Right. So the composition of the transit so far through the Northern Sea Route has primarily been hydrocarbons, oil, LNG. Can you give us more information on that?
Well, right. I mean, historically, it has been sort of mineral ores, coal, frozen food. Well, as I said, it was part of this so-called northern supply. But the real pickup in the overall transportation turnover happened when Russia started developing big oil and gas projects in the Arctic. And so oil shipments, condensate shipments, LNG shipments, they really allowed to increase the turnover quite dramatically. In 2018, the NSR shipments reached 32 million tons. It happened in 2019, and then in 2020 it was about 32 as well. But the ultimate target is to increase this almost threefold to 90 million tons by 2030. And again, this is on the back of the new proposed oil and gas projects in the Arctic, and even more to 130 million tons per annum by 2035. That's a very ambitious goal.
Quite amazing. But let's talk about climate change for a minute, because as I heard you responding to that question, my immediate thought was the kind of impact on the environment. How is climate change affecting the temperatures and ice conditions in the Northern Sea Route water area? You know, do you think the Northern Sea Route will ever become ice-free? And can this become a game changer for shipments via the route? Well, what's your view on that?
Well, it's a very common narrative now that the Arctic is melting. And indeed, the temperatures in the Arctic have been growing much faster than the global average. But we should put these things in context. It's still very, very cold area. Make no mistake about that. The Russian meteorological stations have consistently monitored the temperatures along the NSR water area since the early 1950s. And generally, we have a good track record of what has been happening with regards to temperature change. In the past decade, the winter temperatures in this area were hovering around minus 20 degrees Celsius compared with about minus 24 degrees Celsius on average during 1990. Well, on the one hand, yeah, it's getting warmer, but it's still minus 20. And during the summer, the average temperatures recently have been around plus 4.5 degrees compared with plus 3 degrees in 1970s, 1990s. Well, again, it's a little bit better, but still, it's nothing like tropics. And the NSR water area does get ice-free, but usually it's sort of September is the month when the whole water area may become free. And in the recent history, there were like much warmer years and much colder years. So it can be quite unpredictable. We are looking at a situation when during certain months, August, September, maybe early October, the route can be ice-free. But for most of the time, it still is covered with ice. The question is how thick the ice is and whether it's multi-year ice, which is more difficult to navigate. There are there may be ice ridges formed on those multi-year ice areas. That's about this, really. But I don't think we're talking about complete freeing of the water area from ice. It will be very seasonal, and it still would require specialized ships and a lot of nuclear icebreaking support to navigate the Northern Sea Route. But Russia is putting a lot of efforts into developing all these capabilities, ship capabilities and nuclear icebreakers capabilities, to ensure that the route can be navigated year-round. sort of that's the big bet and big ambition right there.
Well, why do we talk about the icebreaker capacity for a few minutes? Because, you know, it's obvious from what you've said earlier on the importance of having Russia's nuclear icebreakers to ensure safe navigation. So, you know, are there going to be enough icebreakers to meet the needs of shippers? And, you know, will the new nuclear icebreakers have greater capabilities that can actually ensure all year round traffic, which you've just been talking about? So what's your view on the capacity of the icebreakers?
Well, first of all, Russia is the only Arctic nation that has a fleet of nuclear icebreakers. Other countries, they have diesel-powered icebreakers, but Russia is the only one with the fleet of nuclear icebreakers there. It comes back to the Soviet developments in the 1960s. Sort of the first nuclear icebreaker called Lenin was launched then. And then several other more powerful icebreakers were put into operation in the 1970s and 1980s. Currently, there are six nuclear icebreakers on active duty, and three of those are approaching the limits of the economic life, and two on active duty. Very modern, launched in 2020 and 2021, Arctic and Siberia, and they're very powerful. And now another one from this series is coming into operations, I think, this year. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Then the plans are to continue building this series of powerful icebreakers. They can navigate through three-meter thick ice and maintain relatively high speeds. But then the great ambition is to build a new generation of nuclear icebreakers, the so-called Leader series, and powered by a very powerful propulsion system, 110 megawatt. And they will be able to travel through 4-meter thick ice and maintain high speed when cutting through 2-meter thick ice. Basically, that would allow year-round navigation through the Northern Sea Route, because for most of the way, 2-meter thick ice is something that we are going to see in the future. The key challenge is really sort of how quickly you can go through this ice. For example, Arc 7 LNG tankers, they can go through 2-meter thick ice because sort of they are capable of traveling through ice, but their speed is greatly reduced when they have to cut through ice. And so the key challenge would be to maintain high speed. And that's what the new generation of nuclear icebreakers is going to do.
I must admit, looking at your paper, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, nuclear icebreakers have been actually around for so long. For example, the first one that was the icebreaker Lenin in 1959 starting service. I didn't realize it goes on. Again, it's in the paper for you all to read. But you've talked about the kind of the availability of ice-resistant tankers and LNG carriers. Now, how do you think Russia's going to respond to the challenge of that availability? And do you think the ships will be built in foreign or probably in Russian yards? What's your view on that?
Well, we have some history. And for example, Yamal LNG project developed by Novatek, their concept, of course, was to provide for maximal self-sufficiency because nuclear icebreakers can be very expensive. So they invested a lot of money into making their LNG tankers self-sufficient, capable of traveling through ice. And these are the so-called Arc 7 tankers or LNG carriers. They can navigate independently. They basically need a nuclear icebreaker support only for certain parts of the way. Those were built at the Korean shipyards, because Russia at the time, when the project was about to be launched, basically didn't have the capabilities. But since then, and especially since the Russians have realized that this whole big program of Russia's LNG production growth is going to involve a lot of new construction of those ships, Russia made sure that some of the new ships are built in Russia. And Russia's leadership has invested a lot into creating domestic shipbuilding capabilities. And most important development to watch is the so-called Zvezda shipyard in Russia's Far East. That's where sort of Russia's construction of military ships has been combined with building those specialized Arctic ships. And for the next generation of Russian LNG projects, for example, Novatek placed orders partly at South Korean shipyards and partly at the Zvezda shipyard. And so that's the way Russia is going to use the economic multipliers to make sure that jobs, investments, they just not go abroad, but also develop Russia's economy by placing those orders for growing numbers of ships domestically.
Okay, now let's go back to kind of use of the Northern Sea Route. You know, so given the predominance of oil and condensate and LNG shipments in the overall movements via the Northern Sea Route currently, what is the outlook for Russian hydrocarbon development projects in the Arctic, and who are the main players? You know, can Russia's ambitious targets for the Northern Sea Route turnover, which you referred to earlier on the podcast, in 2030 perhaps be upset by upstream projects falling behind schedule? You know, so are the projects going to be there to support the proposed or the planned Northern Sea Route movements?
Well, yeah, I think it's always the risk when you have sort of big, gigantic programs of developing oil and gas projects in very difficult conditions. And in order to realize those projects, you also need to build ships. In order to build those ships, you need to sort of to build new shipyards. And this creates tremendous complexities. And the challenge is always sort of that one part of this task may fall behind, and then obviously for the whole caravan to maintain its speed, you need to watch for the slowest ship, so to say. And in this sense, there's always a risk that if any part of the development somehow is got out of sync, then there's a danger. But there might be delays, and I think there will be delays, but generally Russia is pretty much on track of meeting at least the first part of the goal, which, just to repeat, is reaching 90 million tons of transportation turnover through the NSR by 2030. And again, it may slip a little bit, but given the progress of Russian new LNG projects in the area so far, I think we are looking at pretty much being on track with that. This builds on the strengths of the Yamal LNG project, which has been put into operation ahead of time and on budget. Now Novatek has increased its capabilities already by investing into Arctic LNG 2, which is, like, according to Novatek's estimate, is 70% complete. And it's going to introduce a lot of new additional LNG traffic. And again, sort of expanding on that. Plus, there are projects by Gazpromneft, Novoportovskaya development in particular, which is both oil and gas. Gas is being sent to mainland via the pipeline. They just built a new pipeline, which allowed them to send gas into Russia's high-pressure gas transportation network. But oil is being evacuated by oil tankers from the area. Then another big project, which is really sort of a bet on the future, is the so-called Vostok oil development by Rosneft. And this is a really a major bet on the future, a big project that is going to be developed in the 2030s and 2040s and beyond that.
Well, why do we kind of, you know, I like to always end podcast recordings by kind of a forward-looking question. So why don't we kind of focus on that? Because you're going to have your ramp-up of LNG exports, primarily from, of course, the new Novatek project on the Yamal and the Gidan Peninsula. But also, you know, you mentioned the huge Vostok oil project. So now, can you perhaps share with our listeners, you know, about Rosneft's strategy of these kind of big-ticket investments in oil and gas? And I'm just wondering, doesn't that contradict with the whole energy transition narrative and the claim that new investments into hydrocarbons, you know, will be in the kind of guise of energy transition targets. How does that all fit together, Vitaly?
Well, Rosneft and Igor Sechin, the head of Rosneft, well, obviously not buying this narrative of the imminent end of the oil age. I think this big development is really a bet that even if indeed there will see some decline in overall oil demand in 2040s and later on, still Russia apparently is intent on remaining on the low end of the global cost curve. So even if global oil demand declines in the future, Russia still remains competitive and remains on the market when sort of other high-cost producers would have to give way. And in this sense, the Arctic developments is basically is a long shot. Russia is not giving up. Russia is not sort of is not following sort of these ideological pressures. Very often, sort of a lot of ideological pressure to stop all oil and gas developments come from people who support energy transition and claim that basically, in order to survive, we need to stop using hydrocarbons. I think, well, in Russia, this is not something. This is not the idea that has taken off the ground, especially at the political level. It's considered to be basically too ideological, too communist, in fact, because sort of a utopian in a sense. Russia's leaders, I believe they now take the energy transition agenda seriously, but still they intend to maintain investments in oil and gas and remain competitive longer term. And in this sense, it's a sort of it's a bet. It's a bet on the future. It's an interesting bet, and we will see how it is going to play out. Well, the winter of discontent we are watching in Europe and high energy prices, I think they're a powerful reminder that energy transition might become messy, might become difficult, and that that we still might need oil and gas for quite a long time.
Yep. And, you know, the message is watch this space, and we at the OIS will continue to write papers and carry out research on this exact subject. Look, Vitaly, thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed our conversation, as always. And that builds on the messages from your paper, The Northern Sea Route, a State Priority in Russia's Strategy of Delivering Arctic Hydrocarbons to Global Markets, that was published in November 2021, that includes maps and includes tables and builds very much upon what Vitaly has talked about today. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.